I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
On today's New Statesman podcast, we talk about exam results in England, Wales, and Northern Ireland. And you ask us, why do you think Priti Patel's a good political operator anyway? So exam results are out after a fashion in Wales, Northern Ireland, and England, using a version of the moderation process similar but different to the one used in Scotland last week, causing a great deal of pressure in particular on Gavin Williamson, the Secretary of State for Education in England. Yeah, Al, do you think there's any possibility that he will be able to avoid ending up in a similar position policy-wise to the Scottish government?
I'm not sure. I mean, definitely it's what they are trying to avoid with this triple lock, as it's been called. So the way students can either take these results that in many cases, in like 40% of cases, have been downgraded today, they can either take these results or submit their results from their mocks to be considered, or they can retake the exams in the autumn and can take the, I think, well, there's a bit of confusion as to whether you will definitely be able to take the better mock result if it was better, because I think there are questions over the exact circumstances of the mocks and which mock results would be valid and which wouldn't be. But yeah, in general, I think the way these caveats have been brought in at the last minute, giving people different routes of appeal and different ways of changing their results, I think probably means that we won't get into a situation where pupils will just be able to keep the results that teachers predicted for them. It is a huge mess. I think that your point, because you've been writing a lot about this in recent days, I think that your point is the best one I've seen on this, that ultimately, like, it's asking an exam system and schools to correct a problem that they didn't cause. Like, ultimately, like, no exams happened this year. So kind of whatever result comes out of this will be a massive fudge and hugely frustrating and disappointing to people, because, you know, without proper exams, there can't really be proper results. Anything else that kind of obscures that fact probably isn't an adequate response to this problem.
Yeah, as you say, I've been writing a lot about this, and it was one of those things where, well, I was trying to do, because I've been very late doing my July, because it's now in the middle of August, my sort of July kind of like, here's what I think I've got wrong, but I was kind of thinking, like, well, okay, so in March, when I read Ofqual's press release and its blog, and both they and Qualifications Wales have actually, I think, been like the model of how a quango should behave transparently in this, right? Though this is the weird thing, right? They have actually both, like, they've performed very well in terms of the absurd task set to them. But the problem is that, like, there are no exams. It's, I think it's a great example of two, like, things that big organisations often get wrong. One, the central problem is actually so ridiculous that people don't say it out loud because they feel silly. But the second you go, like, why are these exam results unfair? Well, because there are no exams to have results on. You suddenly go, like, oh yeah, wait a second, this is a stupid exercise, isn't it? Like, we're literally doing something insane. Yeah, like, for example, Well, actually, you know, I was about to compare it to the Premier League, which is in many ways, right, Wales is more like the Premier League, right? In that when the Premier League stopped, they'd played like 32 games. It was, you know, very apparent that Liverpool were going to win the league. Really, the only difference, which would obviously been very close to my heart, would have been that Arsenal would have finished above Spurs on a points per game calculation if it had stopped at the restart. They would still have got European football one way or the other because we won the FA Cup and they obviously, well, they also won their cup final 2-1. But what the exam board being asked to do in England, Scotland and Northern Ireland is basically go, the Olympics haven't happened. Just look at like how the countries did in Beijing, London and Rio and just kind of assign some medals like on. And you can do that in any number of ways you want. You might learn something about the quality of the body that you've asked to perform this silly task. But in the end, right, if you're an employer or you're Nike, you're not going to be like, ah, yes, time to give a sponsorship deal to that gold medal athlete. If you're a university, you're still being given a bunch of pupils who do not have qualifications in a meaningful sense. Many of whom, like, the weird thing is, I think we kind of keep talking about, like, yeah, people keep, like, inventing these, like, desirable case studies or writing about these actual case studies, right? But, like, so let's take, say, someone who's, like, parents are both doctors or both teachers or, like, someone who we would expect to, like, do very well both in their exams and in this system because they probably have been ranked one or two by their own teachers. So, well, bluntly, I think if both your parents are doctors during a novel pandemic, you probably aren't as university ready as your older sister was 2 years ago. That probably is going to be a harder job of work for your higher education institution to integrate you into study. If you are someone, you know, with a family of five in a small flat, ranked top in your class, similarly, you're getting your three A's. But again, you're probably not as uni ready as you would have been 2 years ago, unsurprisingly. And this is basically just like what happens if you say to someone, and this is, yeah, I think does happen in cabinet government all the time, where you kind of go like, here's a labour market problem. Please solve it using secondary schools or please solve it using the DCMS. And inevitably, like any solution you have is bad. You can be less, significantly less bad if you are have more modular modes of assessment. I mean, I saw on BBC News earlier some Welsh pupils actually thanking Kirsty Williams, the Liberal Democrat Education Minister in the LibLab coalition there, for how they've approached this. Now, that is partly because she's been in post a long time. She benefits from both policies she's introduced and policies introduced by, was it One Wales in 2013? Or were they alone? I forget the time. But basically introduced by the previous Labour government in Wales as well, which allow you to be more fair because you can have the Premier League option. But broadly, this is an insane thing to do, and it's going to annoy people however you do it. It's just you can do it slightly better if you are Wales rather than the other three countries of the United Kingdom.
Yeah, so I'm going to be exposing my ignorance here slightly and should have checked this before we started talking about it, but I'm sure other people listening will be unclear about this. So the triple lock that Gavin Williamson has introduced, is that only available in England or does it also cover Northern Irish and Welsh results?
It's only available in England.
And then in Wales, Kirsty Williams has guaranteed that if students get results that are worse than their AS results, they will get the better result, or like it won't be possible to be downgraded from their AS results. I've been looking for what guarantees are being given to students in Northern Ireland, and I'm not actually seeing any yet, unless Northern Ireland is allowing appeals, I think, but the triple lock doesn't seem to apply.
Yeah, so this is only an England-only solution. The Welsh government is basically going, well, there's a backstop of your A-levels, and for GCSE, most people will still have done coursework, right? So there's a backstop of sort of people's actual assessments, which I do think this continues to be a really interesting example of how people do not experience fairness in the aggregate, right? Now, obviously, it is deeply unfair to have your results partly guaranteed by your AS levels if you did not know that they were set in stone. Now, I think that it's actually better, we should have kept AS levels in England but banned resits, but you know, that's a debate for an entirely different time. But it's slightly unfair, but you've at least had an opportunity to shape your own destiny. Coursework, yeah, has a number of potential inbuilt unfairnesses, but you've been given an opportunity to shape your own destiny. So that just feels more fair. What I think is interesting about the seeming lack of outcry in Northern Ireland thus far is, to litigate another education point, right? This is what the 11 plus does anyway, right? like there will be less outrageous drops due to moderation, because the gradient among schools, right, is already so stark. And I just think it's fascinating. I'm really fascinated to see how it plays out. You know, broadly, it seems to me, I find it so hard to get my head around the fact that grammar schools are still accepted across the whole country. But this is just what the 11 plus does in a kind of, but with an algorithm doing it rather than with like the remorseless logic of separating kids at 11 doing its usual thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's actually interesting that it is actually very difficult to talk about A-level results without coming around to a conversation about grammar schools and about the 11 plus, as well as about, I suppose, the differences between not only grammars and secondary schools, but between private schools and state schools. Yeah, I think it's an interesting one. And having obviously grown up in Northern Ireland and gone through the Northern Irish grammar school system, I'm sure I have the biases of someone who has benefited from it personally. But my dad was a teacher in Northern Irish secondary school and has a very different perspective on it. But I know lots of people listening in England don't have much of a sense of how the school system works in Northern Ireland. But as you say, it's a grammar school system really rather than a private school system. Like, there are a handful of private schools in Northern Ireland, but they're really like on the fringes of the education system. They aren't necessarily considered the best schools in Northern Ireland. The best schools tend to be grammar schools. And as you say, until about a decade ago, the 11 plus was compulsory here. And then when it wasn't, it's been a sort of political football, the 11 plus, for a very long time here, but it was scrapped by Sinn Féin about a decade ago. And in its place is basically a worse 11 plus system, where all of the grammar schools in Northern Ireland still get students to sit an 11 plus, but it is privately run. You have to sign up and pay for it. You sit it in an exam centre. So rather than everyone sitting that exam in their state school and being prepared for it by their teachers to an extent, I mean, that clearly varies across schools, and some richer students benefit from a lot of tutoring for it. But it's gone from a system where at least everyone sat it in reasonably fair conditions to only the people who opt in and pay for it can even sit the exam in the first place. So it's a sort of there's even more of a gulf between grammar education and secondary education here. So as you say, there will be a huge difference in the results coming out of grammar schools and secondary schools. I mean, actually, a lot of secondary schools don't go up to A level here, so it would be mostly grammar schools getting these results anyway. But yeah, basically the difference in attainment is so baked into the system that it's completely normalized. You know, people make a case in favor of grammar schools here as sort of distinct from the English one. People make a case for it, especially when everyone sat it, by arguing that grammar schools have like can leverage huge amounts of social mobility for children from deprived backgrounds if they pass the 11 plus and do well. So, you know, last week we were talking about John Hume on the podcast, and Claire Hannah actually mentioned how he would have been a number of like Catholic schoolboys who benefited from the 11 plus and going to a grammar school, sort of, and how that actually had loads of political consequences for Northern Irish politics, that suddenly there was an educated Catholic middle class prepared to engage in politics and make a very nuanced progressive nationalist case for sort of the first time. Yeah, it is just interesting that like, as you say, that maybe will just mean that there isn't the same outcry here, because I think people accept that there is a huge difference in attainment between secondary and grammar schools, and it's perceived to be more fair because it was based on attainment age 11. But also people here would tell you, I never heard the end of this when I was at school. People here talk about how the difference in attainment between the most privileged and the least privileged in Northern Ireland is much smaller than it is in England. The gulf is much, much wider in England, where you have like incredibly high standards of education in some of the most expensive private schools. Like, the education that you get at Eton is amazing compared to some of the like most struggling deprived schools. Like, that gulf is absolutely enormous, and it means that on average Northern Irish school pupils do perform better, and that's used to kind of justify this system.
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
Right, so this is a question I'm being held to account this week. So fairly recently, Stephen described, I love getting to describe myself in the third person, Priti Patel in fairly glowing terms. I can't remember the exact phrasing he used, but it was something about how smart a political operator she is. As someone broadly on the left and consumer of the New States, I have to find Stephen's assessment of Patel confusing. I expect I'm not alone in this. She seems to lurch from gaffe to crisis of her own making to crisis of her own making. I don't find her personally impressive and I don't like her politics. Does my bias and distaste for her politics mean I'm missing what she is good at and what she's uses she to the government? Why do you think she is a good political operator? And so one of the reasons why I thought this would be an interesting question is, actually, I mean, guess Alva, you were, it wasn't just, and I wanted to, you know, talk about myself in the third person. Do you want to talk about why you thought this was an interesting question?
Yeah, so I thought this was a very good observation from that listener. I think that you were maybe talking about Priti Patel in a week that I was on holiday. But yeah, this is definitely one of your opinions on Priti Patel, that she understands a particular strain of thinking in the Conservative Party and in the Conservative base and caters to it better than almost any other Conservative politician. And I now completely agree with that. So I think that it's hard for me to remember what I thought before you said it. But I think that, yeah, this is really one worth talking about, because as is alluded to it in the question, a lot of people on the left really strongly dislike Priti Patel for like quite obvious reasons. Like, as you say, like lots of people hate her politics and what she represents. And then also find, you know, for example, the reason that she was fired from the cabinet last time around and other perceived gaffes, find that to just be evidence of a wider incompetence. But I think that it's very helpful to think about the role that she plays for the Conservative base, but the Conservatives' messaging, their wider political direction. I suppose like this is a good question to be thinking about this week, because we've been seeing a lot of very sad coverage of refugees / migrants making like very treacherous journeys across the channel in tiny dinghies. And there's been a lot of debate about how that coverage has been conducted and then about how Priti Patel and the Labour Party have been responding. And it's another example of her very much appealing to that kind of mindset of a sort of a hang 'em and lash 'em, authoritarian, closed borders mentality. Describing that in crude terms. But I mean, I was saying to our producer, Nick, before we started recording, I find this one very difficult because, you know, there's that relatively recent analysis of the way political divides work these days, that the main divide is between open and closed, so roughly sort of cross-border, metropolitan, open borders, international cooperation, pro-immigration position that would be, I suppose, broadly represented by the Remain position in the UK, plus closed, so people maybe not from bigger cities who are in maybe more precarious work situations, who feel like there is no room for immigration from an economic perspective, but also who dislike the big cultural changes that high levels of immigration are bringing in. With that kind of analysis of the starkest divide in politics, I think it means that like people who have an open mentality don't understand why anyone would like Priti Patel, but like the case for her being a very good politician and and arguably a very successful one, is that she understands the closed mentality better than maybe anyone else. Is that fair, Stephen? Is that why you think that she's a good politician?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, I think that, yeah, in some ways, I know this is a deeply gnomic and obnoxious answer, but like, the reason why I think Priti Patel is a good political operator is precisely the same reason why, and actually, you know, I know lots of our listeners got in touch to, you know, explain why they both agreed and shared my horror at the possibility that Priti Patel may one day become our prime minister. But the reason why she is good at politics is precisely that level of visceral horror and repellence that makes it hard for people to accept the idea that she is. Now, it's obviously her operational competence is demonstrated by the fact, and or lack thereof is demonstrated by the fact that she, you know, had to resign for essentially, you know, freelancing her own foreign policy, and then they have found it necessary to kind of give her this protective ring of quite competent ministers of state in order to sort of make that department run semi-functionally. But her political talent is, despite all of those very real operational problems, the reason why she's been protected and is so essential to this government is she is a symbol to a large chunk of their voter base that this is a government for them. You know, she crucially is obviously like a person from somewhere. Yeah, like she has a clear, you know, a clear accent. She clearly embodies the values of a part of that coalition. But also in terms of like the key to the Conservatives staying in office with a decent sized majority is their ability, and indeed one of the key ways that Leave was able to win, is through maintaining the kind of chunk of the, and I think open v closed is yeah, it's one of those phrases I personally don't like, but I think it's a very useful schema. But through essentially through maintaining the support of open Leave voters and open Conservatives, right? And I think I've said this about, yeah, about one of the reasons why I thought UKIP should have gone for Stephen Wolfe, right? There's a chunk of the country that really wants to be told by an ethnic minority politician that it's okay for them to not want immigrants to come here, including actually a non-trivial chunk of ethnic minority British voters. And she just speaks and articulates that stuff incredibly well. Now, obviously, she's helped by, you know, to use an example this week, like, I mean, I think there were lots of things about how this coverage of these, I mean, one, the coverage of these comparatively small movements of people, yeah, and deciding that the way to try and do that was, yeah, like, why don't we see if we might end up watching some people drown live on air, which I just think wildly overstates the extent of the, like, ultimately, right, the UK, United Kingdom and France both have obligations under international law to provide sanctuary for refugees. And there is an argument between the United Kingdom and France, who are two, you know, perfectly stable countries who are both perfectly capable of rehousing these infinitesimally small number of people without any sort of difficulty. And the fact that our media immediately ends up in such a hysterical place on it, I think is deeply troubling, considering that it feels likely, to put it mildly, then by the 2030s, we will be seeing much larger movements of people because of the climate crisis. And indeed, we may before that be seeing much larger groups of people because of, you know, the ongoing disasters in Libya and Syria. And I don't think from how we've reacted to this, and this is obviously something I've been writing for a long time, but the way that we, our politics reacts to these very small movements of people doesn't give me a great deal of faith that we won't end up in a very nasty place when we're having to deal with much larger movements of people. She's very good at embodying that, but she's also very good at the internal party combat stuff, right? Doing a sort of perfectly pitched, oh, here's a speech where I'm, you know, I'm not being disloyal, but maybe I could be your leader, when Theresa May was in some difficulties, which A, future-proofed her when she was sacked, B, having the sense to realise that, you know, to get behind Boris Johnson early. She didn't mount her own operation. She didn't do anything that kind of sort of blotted her copybook. And I think if you compare, let's compare her to Andrea Leadsom, right? Now, Andrea Leadsom, right, is someone who actually does have a record of having successfully implemented things, surprised a lot of people with how well she handled being leader of the House, built alliances on bullying, was basically sacked after 2 minutes at the Department of Business. She never really was given a chance at a major department because she was micromanaged by the chiefs under Theresa May when she was at DEFRA, wasn't really allowed to do very much. and then she was sacked under Beers. Well, what's the difference between her political position and Priti Patel's? None at all, except Andrea Leadsom briefly ran for the Conservative leadership against Boris Johnson, didn't sort of cash her chips in early, and hasn't done a very good job of, like, basically saying to a large chunk of the Conservative grassroots as well, I'm your guy.
Mm.
And Priti Patel has done all of that masterfully, to the point where, instead of it being a like, what do we do? The very fact that we have a situation where someone who holds a major office of state has serious question marks about their operational competence, and we all know that the government's response to that is not only not going to be to put her somewhere less difficult, but could not be, because she embodies their political project. Yeah, I mean, I did actually the other day have a nightmare in which, like, I was in the ITV studio as I was in 2019, but in 2024, and the exit poll came up, and it was just like her head, Keir Starmer's head, Leila Moran's head, and the Conservative majority has gone up by 40. And, like, a bunch of people were like, I don't understand how this could have happened. And I was just, like, sitting there just like, I understand how it could have happened, guys. I understand how it could have happened. And then I started to sink through the floor and it became, you know, more like a regular group. But and that to me is, like, in terms of, like, the point I often like to make, and this is, like, this is not just a problem the British left has. I think in the same ways that, like, Netanyahu, as well as embodying, like, the closed half of the divide, but he also does lots of kind of small things, and if you don't follow it closely, you kind of don't appreciate, but where he kind of, like, is very good at basically being like, hey, do you know whose values I don't have? Tel Aviv's. She's just very good at that kind of, like, hey, do you know whose values I don't have? Sometimes because the difficulty setting is turned down all the way to casual, as it was with the BBC's ridiculous coverage of her being sassy to Ben and Jerry's on Twitter. but also, yeah, because she just does have a brilliant and acute political sense. She does embody the forces that have, and the forces in the coalition that have put the left on its back, not just here, but across large chunks of the democratic world. Yeah. And that, to me, is the thing that I think people are missing if they don't see that she's an effective operator.
Gosh, people are going to be really reading into that dream, Stephen. What it reveals about all of your unconscious's assumptions about where our politics is heading. Not least Leila Moran, who'll be really pleased that your unconscious endorses her for leader on some level.
I mean, I feel like my unconsciousness is probably doing the reverse of endorsing her for leader. In many ways, my unconscious is running interference for Ed Davey. But yeah, I do also think she's just the most fascinating politician of our times, because it speaks to so many trends, right? The fact that literally, this whole conversation we've acknowledged, well, yeah, of course she's not competent. Yeah, like, we've acknowledged that there are those serious question marks about that. And many of the things that people used to sort of see as paramount in politics, you know, valence, so voting on competence, not sort of these cultural fissures. Economic interest, this is obviously someone who, you know, very much her politics are not this kind of, like, you know, she didn't come into politics to level up. Yeah, the kind of dominance of cultural fissures over economic ones, right? She embodies all of those in so many ways, while also being the most authentic child of Thatcher in lots of ways, left in the cabinet, possibly. Actually, now, I mean, I can feel, yeah, Liz Truss, if she listens to this podcast, sharpening her axe when I say that. But, but, you know, she's. I just think in terms of the state, not only of British conservatism, but that kind of arc of successful politics on the right in the democratic world, from Netanyahu to the BJP to law and justice in Poland. I just think she, more than any other politician in the United Kingdom, embodies, understands, and really represents that. And I do think, you know, maybe it won't be next time, but I do think that my nightmare of, you know, an exit poll showing Priti Patel becoming prime minister, unless some way on the left can be found to turn those forces flank, I just do feel that dream will come true.
I think the way you talk about her embodying a particular set of values and positions is the right one, because I think a lot about the way that politics is primarily emotional, and as well as people thinking about the exact message that a politician is making at the point that they watch them or read about them. I think that there's the broader thing about how that politician makes you feel. And even thinking of the difference between her and someone like Andrea Leadsom, I think the difference is just that Priti Patel has a much stronger brand. like you say, it's the reason why she provokes a visceral dislike in people who don't like her politics. Everyone knows exactly what her politics are. And it's a kind of fundamental, like Priti Patel is an embodiment of a kind of tough person with a kind of, I feel like, I mean, I'm not going to describe her in any way that would then have me accused of being sexist, even though I think that there probably is a big gender dimension to the way her image works, a little bit similar to Thatcher. But I think, yeah, the way she sort of is an embodiment of the strict figure telling people what to do, representing a tough line on a certain number of issues, I think, yeah, is very, very compelling. And again, I think that the appeal of Thatcher, have you seen the BBC documentary about Thatcher, Stephen?
Yeah.
I was watching that recently, and the thing that struck me maybe more than anything was the way, basically it was only men, but all of the men who had worked closely with her talked about her in such an emotional and fawning way. It was as though, again, this sounds kind of gross and sexist, but like they kind of enjoyed being bossed around by her, but also kind of loved the more human side. And I think that the complicated emotional relationship that people develop with strong political leaders is something that I think Priti Patel has the potential to have with an electorate, unlike a lot of politicians who just don't inspire emotions like that in the same way.
Yeah, and I think your point about the Thatcher comparison is really well made for a number of reasons, which is one of the things that, yeah, I've been thinking about a lot, yeah, for a long time, but since the 2019 election, in for a variety of reasons, partly because of what happened to Jo Swinson and partly because of the kind of three-year monstering of Diane Abbott, particularly when she became Shadow Home Secretary, is that the fascinating thing about both about that documentary and about kind of like when you talk to sort of the people behind sort of the sort of reimagining of Margaret Thatcher's image is Margaret Thatcher, if you look at pictures of her as education secretary and you then look at pictures of Barbara Castle, right, they consciously looked at why Barbara Castle, who was then the most popular female politician in the country, they looked at what she did and they kind of emulated that from the right. There isn't at present in the United Kingdom an example of a female or ethnic minority politician on the left who has successfully presented a model of national leadership that the ethnic majority and men, and indeed women, in the case of women leaders, are willing to vote for, right? Now, you could say that's partly because they haven't consciously looked at, say, you know, Helen Clark. They haven't looked at other successful women leaders and gone, okay, well, what's the, like, thing you do? Yeah, because obviously I don't think it was the only problem Jo Swinson had, but I think some of her problems were about misogyny. And in an odd way, Thatcher's incredible success at presenting a model of female leadership that male voters and indeed voters of all kinds were so willing to vote for, I think it's created space for other women to come after her, obviously Theresa May, but it's not just, I think, about who gets the top position, it's how many potential contenders who have a sort of plausible chance of it. But she also, through embodying and dominating that image, I think she's made it much harder for a female politician on the British left to emerge, because like they can't consciously emulate this thing that the country believes is successful women leadership in terms of its tone and style, because then they're a left-wing politician channeling Margaret Thatcher and their own party would find that very difficult. But so they're then having to kind of write their own sort of way of doing that, that often, as I think we saw with Jo Swinson, and I do think would have been a challenge for either Becky Long Bailey or Lisa Nandy, and I think did feed into some of the way they were covered. Yeah, I mean, obviously on trans issues, the fact that like their position on those pledges was considered inherently more newsworthy than the male candidate is a good example of that. I just think that is the other thing that she's very successful at, is she is modelling ways of like taking that Thatcher template of how a woman gets men to vote for her, and she's banking those lessons which Thatcher modelled from Barbara Castle, and she's taking and modelling a kind of like, because in some way she's doing a sort of right wing nativist version of the like Obama, I forgive you, you're a great country, we can all come together, But she's doing it for the closed rather than for the open. She's the most interesting politician in British politics, and I hope that I will not have a peg to do a long read about why, because it will mean that my nightmare has not come true. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague, Alva Ray. It's produced by Nick Hilton. Our music is licensed under Creative Commons and is still Devil by the Devil. If you've enjoyed the New Statesman podcast, please do tell a friend. On today's New Statesman podcast, we talk about exam results in England, Wales, and Northern Ireland. And you ask us, why do you think Priti Patel's a good political operator anyway?
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.